Jesus did every day. He was always doing it. And how do you express in a scene, a story, a biblical story, how do you express the truth that whatever the circumstances of your life, including the persecution of Nero in Rome, it can't separate you from God's love? Jesus is there with you. You might be asleep, you might notice him, you might get answers, nothing might be happening, you might be in the dark night of the soul, all this is possible. But faith tells you he is listening, he is with you, he can calm this storm and calm your heart in the middle of it. Even if you're martyred, like the early martyrs, like Jesus on the cross. Jesus' prayer in the agony was for one thing, and Hebrews tells us God heard his prayer. Well, he didn't hear it the way Jesus prayed it, because he had to go through it, or he went through it. Not because of God, but because of Pilate and the high priest and the rest of the ratbags who wouldn't look. But anyhow, it happened to him. But he remained in communion with God. It didn't take him from God's love. And God answered his prayer in the resurrection. Eternity of communion with God. Through death, not drawn back from death. So there's our first scene. I can only leave it with you to ponder. And I won't get definite answers on anything here. But I want to open up for you the possibility that that scene is much more like the baptism scene of Jesus, or that bronze icon of the crucifixion that I showed you, than it is like a simple picture. You don't need it to be a simple picture. Let's go on. This is Jesus every day doing this to people in their lives, calming the sea, the chaos. Then we go deeper even than that. They came to the other side, which is where they were heading, to the country of the Gerasenes. When he'd stepped out of the boat, immediately, well, that's one of Mark's favourite words, he just uses it 50 times or something, Eusis, immediately, a man came out of the tomb with an unclean spirit and met Jesus. He lived among, what a lovely description this is, it's very beautiful. Matthew leaves it out in Luke. He wants, because he's got a lot of other things to put in, so he makes it briefer, but thank God we've got Mark. He lived among the tombs, no one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain, for he had often been restrained with shackles and chains, but the chains he wrenched apart and the shackles he broke in pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. He's crazy. And he's got all that energy that can come with being crazy, you know, whatever it is, adrenaline or something, I don't know what it is. But so he breaks everything and they're scared stiff of him. Night and day among the tombs and in the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with stones. Got the picture? Okay, so that's the scene. When he saw Jesus, which is why we've got to keep showing Jesus to people, in psychiatric wards and everywhere else, so they can feel it in their bodies. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed down before him and shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." So there's a struggle going on. He actually ran up to Jesus. It reminds me of just a little scene at Chevalier when I was teaching 50 years ago. And I just remember this kid. I'll finish the story. There's a staff meeting and I hear about this kid who's obviously a pain in the, real problem. So, but I didn't know them yet. I'm new at the school. And then I went in this classroom and he was the one who used to clean the board and do everything for me, and he was quite a nice little kid. But I had the advantage of not knowing his reputation. I just met him as he was and took him as he was, and he probably thought, oh, here's someone who's not going to pick on me. So he was really friendly and did all the things. So it taught me a lesson, not to listen to staffs when they tell you about, or not to listen to anybody when they tell you about another person who's not there. So in any case, but this kid, I don't know how this all happened, but at one stage, I remember him coming up and grabbing me by my habit, I had a habit on in those days, and kind of pushing me away, because he'd probably loved, you know, what the hell am I, I'm a 20, 34-year-old priest, and do I think I'm a lover? And I mean, he's had four dads, who knows what's gone on in his life, and people have said they love him, but they haven't loved him. And so, but he must have hooked onto me, because he, but what I remember is being told to, physically, to get out of his life, but he had a grip on me, he wasn't going to let me go. And you've all experienced that. People in your life who don't want you in their life, but they won't let you go because they do want you. They just want to know you're real or something. Well, that's what this bloke's doing to Jesus. For he'd said to him, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. Then Jesus asks him, what's your name? This is very sad. And he said, my name is Legion. We are many. We all have a bit of this in us, but some have so much of it in. They don't know who they are. They're this in the morning, this at midday, this at night, you know, and we can all be a bit of this. But he's clearly broken and he's... We're many. He begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country, for there was a... These are the demons in him, the legion. Now, on the hillside was a great herd of swine. Now, these are unclean animals. And you're dealing with a man who's unclean. In an unclean country, you got it? And the unclean spirits begged him, send us into the swine. Let's go into them. Because the swine, that's where they belong. And the swine will go down into the lake. And the lake is unclean. That's chaotic. And they'll go down into the underworld where the demon is. Don't ask me how you work that out physically, but that's what they thought. You just keep going down and down and down and you end up in hell, which is where they belong. So he gave them permission. It's quite a cute story. He gave them permission and the unclean spirits came out, entered the swine, and the herd, about 2,000, smoke, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. Well, if you're a Jew, you'd clap. But if you're a pig herdsman in the country of the Gadarene, there goes your everything you've ever worked for. The swine herd, they ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then the people came to see what had happened. They came to Jesus and they see the demoniac sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. Jesus has brought peace to this poor, deranged man. We already saw him doing it in the synagogue. He did it every day, and he can do it to us too, insofar as we're deranged. So we're going into the deep psyche. What do you do when your psyche is collapsing? Does that take you from the love of God? No, says Mark in this scene. In this scene, how much of it is story, how much of it is based on a particular event that's kind of half remembered? I can't tell you. But we're basically dealing with story that's powerful and has a theological intent rather than a photographic memory. They came to Jesus, see the demoniac there clothed in his right mind, the very man who'd been legion, and they were afraid. Those who'd seen what had happened to the demoniac and to the swine reported it. They began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. So they're caught. They're wanting Jesus to go because he's upsetting their system. What a pity for them when he could have been the great healer. That's still happening. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by the demons begged that he might be with him. Of course he did. So he's there, center stage. Over where I am is the crowd telling Jesus to go. Over there near the door is Jesus and the disciples going to the boats because he's not going to push his way in. And the poor man in the middle here, Does he want to go back with this mob that drove him balmy in the first place? No. He wants to go with Jesus, because Jesus called those whom he wanted to be with him. He wanted to be with him. So would you, I hope, and so would I. But look at Jesus. What a lovely act of trust this is. Go home to your friends. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you. The Lord is Yahweh, the name for God in the Jewish world. And what mercy he has shown you. So he went away. Jesus is saying, it's okay, mate. You were a drug addict, but you're healed now. Go into the jails and tell them about it. Like, if I go in, they know I know nothing about drugs, never having taken them, never having to suffer for them. Well, it's nice, I can be kind to them, but wow, here I've got a drug addict who's stopped and been healed. Isn't he the best person to go in? He can go in now and, from his own experience, which they'll kind of locate, say, look, there's hope, there's something beyond drugs. Well, this bloke goes back, began to proclaim in the Decapolis, that's in this east of the Jordan, how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed. So he becomes a missionary. And we don't know the fruit of that mission, but we don't know, but we presume it was wonderful. So there's another story. How much of it is based on an event, I don't know, and you can't actually tell from stories, but it's truthful in it's telling us in a hardly forgettable way that God in Jesus is not just about healing our body from physical ailments, it's about healing our soul, our psyche, us at our deep level. Now we come to the climax, the third scene. They're getting bigger all the time. Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, so he's back home. A great crowd gathered round him, and he was by the sea. One of the leaders of the synagogue, named Jairus, came, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begs him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be well again and live." And the word "well" and "saved" is the same Greek word, sozo. So that she may be saved. Find meaning in her life, find recovery, find life, come back to me, her dad, all of that. So what does Jesus do? He went with him. So he's an important man in the district. And Jesus loves everyone. A large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who'd been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. 12 will come back again. We're back into the 12 apostles, the 12 tribes, the 12 constellations. We're dealing with comprehensive heavenly love. Okay. Now hemorrhages was a problem. It's in the book of Leviticus again. It was another taboo they had because, as far as I'm able to understand it, or the scholars teach me, the problem with these hemorrhages, they came out of the part of a woman's body where a child would come. That part which is meant to bring life into the world is actually bringing death, blood. So it's taboo. There's a fear attached to it. So the woman wasn't allowed to be in the crowd. She wasn't allowed to be with people. But like the leper, she's not going to be kept away from Jesus by any law. So she's there. She'd endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better. Well, there we are. Hello, all us. But rather, she grew worse. I don't think the doctors would have liked that bit of the story, but anyhow, that's in there. And Luke, in fact, who is a physician, includes it, so it's okay. She'd heard about Jesus, came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. For she said to herself, "If I could only touch his clothes, I'd be made well." So she wants her touch. Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and he said, "Who touched my clothes?" his disciples, who thought Jesus was far too naive, really, for the real world. His mother had looked after him too well. He needed a bit of life. They said, look, for God's sake. Well, they wouldn't say that, but look at the crowd pressing in on him. What are you talking about? Who touched me? They're all touching him. He's in the middle of a mob. But Jesus had been touched in a faith touch. He looked around to see who'd done it. And the woman, knowing what had happened to her, so he's inviting her not just to be physically healed, he wants her to be saved. He wants this to be a miracle. And by miracle, the early church, forget modern definitions which are based on philosophy of Hume and the rest of them. In the ancient world, a miracle had to have two things to be a miracle. It had to be something wonderful that caused wonder, of course. But that wasn't enough for a miracle. We'll see that later in Mark. It had to be a sign. It had to be a wonderful thing that showed people God was present, acting, loving, creating, healing, etc. So you need both for a miracle. A wonderful occurrence that causes wonder and takes us into communion with God. So that's what Jesus wanted. He wanted to bring her close to deeper healing. He looked around. The woman said, fell down and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith. He doesn't say, I made you well. He said, your faith made you well. In other words, God is the healer, and faith is the welcoming of the healing. We have to welcome it. We have to be open to it. And she's open, so it happens. God isn't there waiting to see when he'll do something nice. God's there all the time, inspiring absolutely everyone in this world to love. Some are listening, some are half listening, some are not listening at all. Well, if they don't listen, evil things will occur, and so on. But he wants her, she's listening. Your faith, your welcoming of love has made you well. Go in peace. Be healed of your disease. So she's come to a communion with Jesus. We're all asked to do that. And well, the story speaks for itself. But it leads on to this. While he was still speaking, because he's delayed, the man had asked him, and Jesus is going with the man, and they ran the show, in, at least outside the home, probably still much the same, but they did all that. And now a woman comes in and takes up a bit of time, and Jesus looks after her. But the delay, he was still, some people came from the leader's house and said, look, your daughter's dead, don't trouble the teacher any further. It's too late, she died like 5 minutes ago or whatever. Overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, don't fear, believe. In the English, anyhow, I could put it, believe comes from the Dutch liefde, leave, L-I-E-V-E is a contraction of the word love. So it, be in love, be in God's love. Be in it, it's all around you, so be in it. Don't be afraid. He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James and John, the brother of James. And we're going to find the same three at the Transfiguration, the same three at the agony in the garden. So they're an inner group of very close companions. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he sees a commotion, obviously. They hired people who came in, that was their job. And they wail away, and they probably feel sad, but they may not. They're just doing the ritual. Wailing loudly, and when he entered, he says to them, what are you making commotion? Why are you doing all this commotion and weeping? The child isn't dead, but sleeping. At a tangent, burial sites. The Christians started to call them cemeteries. Cemetery means, in Greek, a place of sleeping. So that's a Christian innovation. And the word is now taken for granted, but it actually means not a place for the dead, but a place of sleeping, waiting for the resurrection. Well, he said, they're not sleeping. And they laughed at him, and he put them all outside. Don't know how he managed that, but he did. And he took the child's father and mother and those who were with him, and he goes in where the child was. another shift of tents by Mark, because he wants us all to go in there too. He goes in, so we go in. Taking her by the hand, he says to her, and this is very important, Talitha kum. It's not abracadabra. We're not dealing with a magic here. This is an Aramaic word, Jesus' language. So they've got the word in there just to show that this is human encounter we're dealing with, not a magical thing. Little girl, rise up. Talitha, little girl, kum, rise up. And the word for rise up is exactly the same word used for the resurrection of Jesus. Rise up. She was 12 years of age. I can't say much more about that. Interesting that the woman had 12 and is a 12 again, but you may see meanings in it that I can't, but it's something, anyhow, there it is. It connects the two stories. At this, they were overcome with amazement, and he strictly ordered that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat, which is so cute and lovely and practical. And you feel there's a memory in there somewhere. So again, we're dealing with a big story. Is it meant to lead me? Obviously, I don't have children, but anyway, say I did have a 12-year-old child who was dying of something. Does it mean I should be confident that my child will be raised back to this life? I don't think so, because that's not what it may happen sometimes. Extraordinary circumstances that are beyond science and all that. But in general, that won't happen. We all end up dying. Even our 12-year-old children die. But what it does do to the early church in Rome and everywhere else is make them realize that when I die, when she dies, when we die, Jesus will be there to take us by the hand and take us into communion with God forever, into real life, full life, eternal life, communion with God. So death can't separate us. Not even death can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus, because from God's point of view, death is just a horizon that goes beyond what we see into life. If we have faith. And now the tragedy. You'd think after all that, everyone would be saying, Jesus, for God, this is wonderful stuff. And everybody would have been converted and so on. Jesus left that place. He comes to his hometown. And his disciples follow him. On the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astounded. They said, where did the man get all this? What is this wisdom that's been given to him? He didn't go to the rabbinic school. He's not a rabbi in any official sense. He's a lay person. He's not a priest. He couldn't be, of course, because he's of the tribe of David, not the tribe of Levi. So he's not any of the educated people. But here he is with this wisdom and wonder. And these deeds of power, well, we've just seen three massive ones, deeds of power, miracles, has been done by his hands. And now look at what made them balk. So there's all this wonderful. He says, isn't this the carpenter, the son of Mary? Is that an indication that Joseph has died? Yes, but even if Joseph had died, they'd normally call, his name was Yeshua bar Yosef, the son of Joseph. Is there an indication, I'm only suggesting this, I actually don't think it is this, but some say it could be. Is this a suggestion that it was known in the village that Mary had a child out of wedlock, you know? And so that would have been Joseph understood. We're not going to do Matthew, but he understood beautifully what was happening. And Mary did. But did the people around, did they? Did Mary have to live with whatever? Because villages can be pretty... In any case, he's called here the son of Mary, and that is unusual. Now here, he's the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon. So they're named his brothers. And his sisters are here with us. And they took offence at him. I'm going to jump a minute, if you don't mind. At the foot of the cross, as described by Mark, there are a number of women there. He doesn't mention Mary the mother being there. That's a fact. He doesn't mention it. Doesn't mention she wasn't there. But ones that are mentioned are... there's a Mary there that's mentioned. And when that Mary is described, it's Mary, the mother of James. Well, that's this James, of course, and all the rest of them. Which, to me, is quite a proof that it wasn't Mary, the mother of Jesus. Because if you're watching the scene and Jesus is centre stage on the cross and there's a Mary there, wouldn't you say Mary, the mother of Jesus, that we're talking about? You wouldn't say Mary, the mother of the bloke we mentioned back in chapter 6. It's almost dramatically impossible, which is another way of indicating that James and Joseph and Judas and Simon were extended family, but not blood brothers of Mary, of Jesus. I'll leave that. They took offence at him, and here we come to the conclusion. Jesus said to them, "Prophets are not without honour except in their own hometown and among their own kin and in their own house." We can get so familiar. We can get familiar with God. We can get familiar with the Blessed Eucharist, can't we? We can get familiar with the saints. We can get familiar with the church and not realising, with all its faults, because I'm in it and you're in it and people are in it and there's sin there, as there's going to be always, because Jesus eats with sinners. So if the sinners weren't there, you wouldn't be in the right church. So we're kind of all gathered there. But we're not meant to stay sinners, but we're meant to be, we're loved as sinners so that we won't sin. Paul's big insight. I was still a sinner when he loved me. He never forgot that. So, okay, that's the church. But we can sometimes look at all that and people say they're leaving the church because the priests do this or the preacher is hopeless. Well, he may be, and maybe something should be done about it, and maybe you can do something about it too. And maybe you should be sacked even if it's right over off border. But whatever's got to happen, the fact is, it's Jesus present and we're receiving the Eucharist, for God's sake. Let's not lose that because of other minor things that might be getting in the road. So we're like that. We can get familiar with things and miss their depth. And he, look at this. It's only in Mark, but it is here. He could do no miracles. I'm translating it, deeds of power, because that's what the Greek says, there. He couldn't work a miracle in Nazareth. Except that he did lay his hands on a few sick people and cured them. Well, I remember looking at that for years and thinking, well, that'll do me for a miracle. What do you mean he couldn't work any miracles? Yeah, but he did heal a few people who were sick. Well, I've already given you the reason for that. Healing people who are sick is not a miracle. It's a wonderful thing. But for them, because he was amazed at their unbelief, because they didn't welcome God's presence and power and love, they remained at the level of wonder, and it never became a sign to them of the presence of this God that Jesus was revealing. And so, Mark, in these two chapters, I hope I haven't overwhelmed you, and if I have, well, I can't, it's too late now to apologise. But here you've got Mark showing us God's power, drawing on ancient texts, ancient music, ancient psalms. It's full of it, and all there to get us to know the real Jesus and what he was doing every day of his life. But here it's held together in three of the most powerful scenes of the public ministry of Jesus. So here's the teacher again. What is Jesus teaching the crowd and what is he teaching the disciples? That's our question, and here's the answer. It grew late. His disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place. The hour is now very late." So Jesus wasn't beyond getting carried away a bit, probably. And these words are so lovely, the people can hardly notice, but the apostles are thinking, God, it's up past 5 and the shops all close at 6. So Jesus, how about if you just come, like, land somewhere with this beautiful homily you're giving and give us time to get the word. He said, look, send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves something to eat. Some dates and some whatever else. Good advice. And here's the key line of the whole scene. Better translated in the Jerusalem Bible, where it says, you give them something to eat yourselves. You feed them. Well, that went over like a lead balloon. What? We find out there's 5,000 men, so add the women, add the kids. You've got a whopping crowd. They said to him, well, how do you mean? A week to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread. A denarius is a day's wage for picking the grapes and dates and whatever in the picking season, the harvesting season. So 200 denarii is 200 days' wages. They haven't got it. Of course they haven't got it. They've never had it. How are we going to feed them, in other words? And I ask that question. You ask that question. How are we going to feed our kids? I don't mean physically, but how are we going to teach them? How are we going to do? How are we going to manage with these two parishes that have been suddenly brought together by a system that's gone wonkous because it hasn't got enough priests and they don't ordain priests, for heaven's sake. But anyhow, then, so they fiddle around and they bring communities together and the communities don't know and they're in a new church and all this is going on and where you are in the parish council and you're wondering, well, how are we going to actually make this work? How are we going to feed them? And he says to them, well, how many loaves have you got? What have you got to feed them with? They never thought of asking that because it's clear they can't do it. So, oh, well, go and check. What gifts do you have? Who's there in the parish? Who's on the council? Who's in this situation? What's going on in the district? Go and find out. So they do. And they come back with a trump card, which should finish the whole thing, and Jesus will have to give in. We've got 5 loaves, they've scouted everywhere, and we've got 2 fish. So Jesus, we've wasted another quarter of an hour, you've hardly got any time, for heaven's sake, send them away. Jesus ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. They sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. This is a drama. If you read the book of Exodus, chapter 18, they were the units that the people of God kept for protection, of course, like a phalanx. They were the units that they did when they went into the desert. So he's reminding them of the journey in the wilderness where they were hungry and God provided the food. So then, and here the language on the right, left-hand side is the language of Mark. On the right is Mark's words for the Last Supper. Of course you can see a connection between the two. This isn't about the Last Supper. The Last Supper is about this. The Last Supper is a cultic meal to state in dramatic ways the lesson of Mark chapter 6. Taking the loaves and the 2 fish, Jesus looked up to heaven and blessed, which means he praised the one who blesses, God. He broke the loaves. Now this translation is inadequate. And gave them to his disciples. You might know a few languages. I don't know what you know, but I'll tell you the little bit I know. All those are aorist participles or aorist past tense. Taking is an aorist participle. Looked up, broke. Gave is not. Gave in the Greek is an imperfect form of the verb. So it's not telling you what he did. It's telling you what he was doing when something happened. It's taking you into the breaking. The breaking went on and on and on and on is the point. So he continued to give them, he broke, then continued to give them to his disciples. to set before the people. So if you want to imagine this according to the strict language of it, it's nothing like Jesus of Nazareth or some of these Hollywood films or whatever, where you go out with a basket and blah, 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 everything flows out of the basket everywhere. And so the miracle happens in the basket, as it were. No, it doesn't. The miracle happens in Jesus' hands. He's the one who continues to give them. So you be any one of the apostles you want to be Andrew or Thomas or James or somebody, and you come up to Jesus and he gives you a few little broken bits of bread and a few little bits of fish, and that's all you've got because it's all he's got. So he gives you broken, there's a significance in that which has become obvious to you, and you go out and you give it to the front row, the first half a dozen people, and then you run out. You've got no more in the basket. That's it. You've given all you've got. What do? You bring your empty basket back to Jesus and he fills it up again. And then you come back. So the mission is not, this is the lesson he's trying to teach his disciples, also the people. The lesson is, mission is not about you being able to do it all. It's you giving your all to exhaustion, if you like. You've got nothing left. And then you go back to him and he fills you up again to go and give. And it happens. Give us this day our daily bread. So he divided the two fish among them all. Everybody ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces of the fish. And those who had eaten the loaves numbered 5,000 men, etc. So that's the lesson. What actually happened? Don't spoil this story. Some people spoil it and say, oh, what happened was they all had the food, and when Jesus gave them their bit, they all got generous and dug into their packages and gave out more bread and fish. A lovely idea, but hopeless, and nothing like the text. The text, I've done my best to describe it to you. The text is beyond the physical here. It's talking about hunger, real hunger. Hunger is real, but it's talking about what we really need. And that's what we've got in the Our Father, the epiousios bread, the bread that is super substantial, the bread we really need to journey in life. Whether we're starving or got a full stomach, we need this. And this is about, the Eucharist will be about it, as you can tell by the words, taking us back to here. And the Eucharist is our most beautiful place where this happens. But it happens in prayer, it happens every day, it happens all the time. Our mission is not our mission, it's Jesus' mission, which we become a vehicle of insofar as we get out of the road and let him do it. That's the lesson of mission, and the context places it there. It's a powerful story. In fact, it's so powerful it will be repeated in a moment. Behind it, we get some of the language of, here's Isaiah 55, the prophet crying out, well, it's the descendants of the prophet, why do you spend your money for that which is not bread? Why do you labour for what doesn't satisfy? Listen carefully to me. Listen, there it is again. Eat what is good. Delight yourself in rich food. Incline your ear. Come to me. God is speaking, of course. Listen so that you may live. I have made with you an everlasting covenant. Beautiful, consoling faith words. So it's about listening and coming to him, to God, for our nourishment. 2 Corinthians 9:8. God, says Paul, is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance, so that by always having enough of everything, you may share abundantly in every good work. Everyone in this room has all that you need to do God's will. Mightn't do your own will. I mightn't do what I'd like to do. I mightn't be able to do now what I could do 10 years ago when I was healthier and so on. But that's playing with the pieces. I can do God's will. You can do God's will. The parish can do God's will. The church can do God's will. And they'll have all the energy needed to do it and all the grace needed to do it. So look for it. Go and check who could be ordained in your parish. who could preach in your parish, who could whatever. And they're all there in abundance. And the church has to do what our Pope's begging us to do now in general. He hasn't got down to particulars yet. We've got to look around and greet people as people, meet them as people first. And in that lovely environment, of course, we'll help each other become better behaved and better this and better everything else. Why not? But let's start by welcoming the way Jesus does. John 15, 5 is John's way of putting this. Apart from me, apart from Jesus, you can do nothing. Immediately, here's our favourite word again, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And now we have this extraordinary scene. It's so powerful, overwhelmingly powerful. After saying farewell to them, so Jesus went up onto the mountain to pray. So if Jesus needed to go to the mountain to pray, don't you think I need to? And if I get too busy in my ministry to pray, something is going really, 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 really wrong. You can all see that. But it's the same for all of us. If we're too busy to pray, we're too busy. Isogashi, our heart is being destroyed. When evening came, this is the boat, this is the church in Rome. This is the community for whom Mark's writing. This is this broken, bewildered, not coping Christian community in the centre of this massively cruel empire. It's also got good aspects to it, of course, but basically it's built on fear and power and domination. So the boat is out on the sea and he was alone on the land. When he saw that they were straining at the oars against an adverse wind, the way the church is today and has always been, but sometimes it's more obvious, or our religious orders, where there are no novices or some damn thing, and we're getting more and more to do, and the older we get, the more parishes we get to look after, and retirement. We retired at 24, and now we're getting busy. So whatever. The adverse wind, he came towards them early in the morning, walking on the sea. Wow, this is something. What's it telling us? Walking on the sea. I'll show you in a moment. I'll read some of the texts from the scriptures. Walking on the sea. Does that mean that Jesus, who was like me in all things, was different because his feet were more like a platypus or some kind of a seabird? So I could walk on the sea. Or you know what I mean? Or did Jesus actually have to swim in the sea or drown? If he's like us in everything, I suspect the second is right. So it can't be about Jesus going plod, 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 plod along the sea, because what would that prove anyhow? Some people say, oh, that would prove he was God, because God can do anything. And I say, well, go and read Matthew's account of this, because in Matthew's account, Peter walks on the sea too. Remember that? So what, you got another God now? How many gods do you want? Let's get real about all this. Whatever it's about, Jesus is coming to them, walking on the sea. He's not sucked into the chaos. He's rising above the chaos. And I'll read you more texts in a minute. He intended to pass them by. Not sure what that means, but in other words, Jesus will only come if invited. So he's going, he's there. When they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost, and they cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified, which is the appropriate reaction to a theophany. But immediately he spoke to them and said, take heart, have courage. Heart is core, courage is heart. Have courage, it is I. Do not be afraid. Well, if you don't know it, you've got to know it, so I'm now about to tell you. But see, this won't make sense unless you know. The Greek, everyone knew who was reading the Greek New Testament, and then It is I in the New Testament. It's ego, I, eimi, I am. So I am is all it's saying, really. Ego, eimi. Hang on, I am. Hearing it echoing through the darkness and the swirling sea has got to take us back to the burning bush and the desert and Moses. And Moses says to God, who are you? I've got to be able to tell him who sent me. And Moses is expecting something like, I'm the God of this mountain, because there were gods everywhere in those days. No, God just says, Eye Asher Eye in Hebrew. The Greek translated it, Ego Eimi Ha'on. I am the one. It's more philosophical than the practical language of Hebrew. And if I had it there, if you look at it next time it's up there, if you look at Jesus and you look at his halo, and it's on most icons of Jesus, you'll see Ho'on written in the halo. Taken from this text, taken from the book of Exodus, I am. This is the divine name. This is the divine presence. This is Yahweh. This is God walking among us. This is God incarnate. This is God revealed in the human Jesus. Not because he walked on water, for God's sake, but because I am. Don't be afraid. Then he got into the boat with them. And the wind ceased and they were utterly astounded, of course. And why were they utterly astounded? And pardon me, but I'm a slow learner, but I can remember spending years thinking, what is the connection between walking on water and the loaves? I came to see it, of course, thanks to scholars who teach me and stuff you can all read. The loaves is all about us being able to do anything. Everything's possible that God wants to do through us. So had they understood that, they would not have been surprised at being able to cope in the chaos of the swirling storm on the Lake of Galilee. So we've got two scenes together. One is crossing the Red Sea. We've just been watching that. And the other is the manna in the desert. In the book of Exodus, they cross the Red Sea. The very next chapter, 16 of Exodus, the manna from heaven for their journey through the desert. In the Gospels, I'm not exactly sure why, and you may have heard ideas on this. I've got some ideas, of course, but it's the other way around. They're nourished first so that they can walk on water, so that you can walk on water, I can walk on water, the church can walk on water. So they come to land and moor the boat. Some texts, Isaiah 43, thus says Yahweh, he who created you, O Jacob, he who formed you, O Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I've called you by your name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, and we've just watched that, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. Isaiah 51:10. Was it not you, say the prophets, speaking in prayer to God, was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep? This is back in creation. And now, Exodus. Was it not you who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to cross over? The Red Sea. They didn't walk on it, but you know the story. So it is all happening in Rome again, as Mark writes this story that gives them all courage to go through the persecution and the mess. Exodus 15:19, the Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. Psalm 77, when the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. The very deep trembled. Your way, O God, was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters, yet your footprints were unseen. God walks on the water. Jesus is God incarnate walking on the water. Not physically, of course, but really. Job, You stretched out the heavens, you trampled the waves of the sea. And if you wanted more references, I could give you, but sure, there's enough there to get the... This is the trouble with fundamentalism. It fails to appreciate the beauty of this material. It just cuts it short and gets it into a language that we can control and know and be sure about and teach our kids, never having experienced the wonder of this Shakespeare eat your heart out stuff. It's powerful material. When they'd crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret and moored the boat. When they got out of the boat, people at once recognised Jesus. Here we come to a wonderful scene connected with Jesus, what he's just said about the glory of God, the power of God on the third day. It's all connected. 6 days later, and this is like a preview of the resurrection, Jesus takes with him Peter and James and John and leads them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to him Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Elijah, the prophet, Moses, the Torah. This is the Old Testament scriptures, the Torah, the law, and the prophets. So they're all there with Jesus on the mountain of prayer. And the language used here is a language of ecstasy and so on. I'll read to you from Exodus 24, in case there may be a connection. I think there is. The glory of Yahweh settled on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. 6 days later, on the seventh day, Yahweh called to Moses out of the cloud. Exodus 34:30, a description of Moses coming down from the mountain, having been with God for 40 days and 40 nights. We're dealing with imagery here. The Israelites saw Moses, and the skin of his face was shining. They were afraid to come near him. So Jesus is in ecstasy with God in prayer, and the language is the language that you just read. When Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, what to say? For they were terrified. And Peter's remembering this extraordinary occasion of prayer. Then a cloud overshadowed them. And from the cloud came a voice, quite like the baptism. This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him. You've been listening to Elijah and you've been listening to Moses, fine. But now I want you to listen to him. And suddenly they looked around and saw no one with them anymore. There was only so the whole of the Torah has been fulfilled in Jesus and is not to be read except with his eyes and his heart and his words and his revelation. And then what is beautiful in it will be shown in all its fulfilled beauty, and what is limited in it, because it's written by human beings, the priests and thing, whoever wrote it, different hundreds of people wrote it, then the writings, the limits of them will be able to be washed away and seen through and clarified and purified, and it'll all be in Jesus. And the same with the prophets. They looked around and saw no one but only Jesus. That's Raphael's. It's not beautiful there, I'm afraid to say, but if you could see the painting in Rome, please see it. I went to Rome 5 times. And only on the 5th time did I manage to see it, because it was always being restored. I'd go there and then be blocked. Go there again, blocked. 3 years later, I'd go again. And when I went in, it was worth waiting for. So you people, if you ever get a chance to go to Rome, you mustn't miss that painting. It's stunning. But there's more to it than what you've just seen. I'll show it to you in a moment. a comment by Paul, or yes, 2 Corinthians 3:15-18, a beautiful letter, the second letter to the Corinthians. They're all beautiful, but this is. Whenever Moses is read, Moses and Elijah, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their minds. So they're not getting what Moses was reaching for, hinting at, going to be fulfilled by. There's a veil over, he's talking about the Jews who are opposing Christianity. But when you turn to the Lord, Jesus, the veil is removed. Now the Lord is the Spirit. And where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. Paul, one of Paul's absolute key themes, all through the Galatians it is, again and again in his letters, Paul is not interested in anything that isn't free, because free means it's you, not us hanging on to someone else and becoming like it. This saint, and it's not suiting us and it's not us. Freedom is to be who we really are. Freedom for something, but from a heck of a lot of stuff inside and outside. So rightly, and we should be the same, we should be absolutely committed to freedom. And all of us, says Paul, with unveiled faces, seeing the glory of the Lord as though reflected in a mirror, glory of the Lord, that's Yahweh, the mirror is Jesus. He's the icon, the reflection, the mirror, the character of God. Seeing the glory of Yahweh as though reflected in a mirror, we are being transformed into the same image as we look at him. We become like him. From one degree of glory to another. And all this comes from the Lord, the Spirit. It's a very Trinitarian text if you look at it more carefully later. But it's really picking up what the Transfiguration scene is about. Looking at him. Now this next scene is this one here. And breathed his last. So he died remarkably quickly. From mid-morning to mid-afternoon, 6 or so hours on the cross. You could stay on the cross for days, writhing. But he was obviously already nearly dead. Exhausted and then lashed within an inch of his life. And now comes a beautiful, beautiful statement by Mark. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Why wasn't I told? I don't know, but I'm telling you. I think I probably thought that 100 yards down the road, you know, some kind of miracle, God knows why God would play around with curtains, I thought the foggiest idea, and the women in the sodality wouldn't be too happy, they'd have to mend it all. But so here's Jesus dying, and then the curtain 100 yards down there goes, whoosh, some way of God saying, I'll get back, I don't know what. But it's ridiculous. I have to say, pardon, it's not too strong. Let's go back to what the curtain is. The curtain in the temple covered the holiest of places. Only the high priest could dare to go through that curtain once a year on the feast of Yom Kippur. Because when he went in there with incense, etc., there's nothing, there's no vision. There's just the Ark of the Covenant, a box, and on it a golden hilasterion, they called it in Greek, the mercy seat, and then had two statues of, small enough statues of cherubim, these ancient mythical creatures with bits of lion and dog and lion and bull and eagle and human and all that. So they were there, and you find them, by the way, in the Iranian temple still, you can see some of them there. They were to terrify people from not coming into the holy place. Lest, you know, so that kept them out. So they're all there, and then there's the two wings from the cherubim nearly touch, just a little cigarette paper, between them over, and that's where God touches the earth. But God, of course, is invisible. He's there, throned on these cherubim and so on. But he's not there. Well, he is there, but not visible. There's no statue. Well, that was the curtain. And when they often say in the Bible, no one can see God. And they also say they're going to the temple to see God. They mean go to the temple to see, inverted commas, God. But the most they can see is a curtain. Now you've got it. I don't need to go any further, I'm sure. Mark is telling us that when Jesus died, the curtain went. In other words, you can now see the face of God. Jesus. He is the face of God. You can now, everyone can come in. There's nothing hiding God from us anymore. At last, it's fully revealed. Fully revealed in Jesus. Well, I'll let Mark tell you. Actually, I'll let it be said now. The curtain of the temple was torn into, not the one down there, for heaven's sake, but this one. From top to bottom, and most important, when the centurion who stood facing him, Jesus, saw, this is their translation, in this way he breathed his last, saw how he died. He said, truly this man was God's son. Now he hasn't got any theology in his head. He's a Roman centurion. He hasn't been to the Jesuits or anything. And he hasn't read Nicene Creed. He's nothing like that. He's just saying that whatever God is for him, this is clearly divine, what I'm watching here. But what he said, let's go back on it. He saw, it's too long ago to make sure now, but I think I thought, and I know people still teach it, that we're saved because Jesus died. No, we're not. It's not that he died that saves us, it's how he died. Pardon me shouting at you. It's the way he died. Love, patience, faith, belief, heroic holding on when he still, my God, why have you abandoned me? So that's all part of the feeling, but it's not part of the decision that Jesus makes. It's all about forgiveness and love, and the other Gospels will bring it out too, but that's how he died, and that's what impressed. The centurion had seen people die probably for years. He saw two other people that day anyhow, so what? That he died is irrelevant. In fact, it's murder. It's dreadful. It does no good to anybody. But the way he died was utterly impressive, even to a Roman centurion. And Mark, writing probably in Rome, is appealing to the non-Jewish world there to look at Jesus and realize what God is, because they're watching God's Son. 1 Corinthians 1:22, Paul writes 10 years before this, for Jews demand signs and Greeks desire wisdom. We proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews, we've seen that, and stupidity to the Gentiles, making no sense to anybody. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ is the power of God, the wisdom of God. God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom. God's weakness is stronger than human strength. So there is put out for you a little bit what I've already just said. The rending of the temple curtain. The baptism of Jesus. The heavens were rent, torn open, revealing Jesus the baptized. But here is the ultimate tearing. The whole purpose of the temple has achieved its goal, and there's never going to be any blocking the face of God again. Because we've seen God revealed, we've seen his face in the loving, believing Jesus in the hardest, darkest place. You are my beloved Son, we've seen that as well. Mark concludes briefly